Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this second hour of the program, we will explore some of the history of chemical warfare and how it has been used and efforts to prevent the spread of these weapons, perhaps get rid of them altogether. And our guest is Jonathan Tucker. He is the author of a recently published book that's entitled War of Nerves, Chemical Warfare from World War I to Al-Qaeda. It is published by Pantheon. Let me tell you a little bit about him and his background. He has an undergraduate degree in biology from Yale and a PhD in political science, where he specialized in defense and arms control issues from MIT. For the past 10 years, he's been a chemical and biological weapons specialist at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Before that, he worked as an arms control specialist for Congress and the State Department, and also as a journalist. He was editor at Scientific American and High Technology Magazine, where he wrote about biomedical research and biotechnology and military technologies. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. 333-945-5 is the Champaign-Urbana number. So if you're here in and around where we are, if it's a local call, use that number. Otherwise, we do have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. And as a matter of fact, people who might be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Tucker, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
We certainly appreciate it. If to talk about the issue of proliferation right at the beginning, just for a little bit, and then we can go back and look at some of the history that you write about. Chemical weapons are considered to be weapons of mass destruction, along with nuclear and biologicals. If you look at what's involved in producing them, the difficulty in handling them, the difficulties in using them, in deploying and using them. I mean, if you look at the kind of threats posed by those three things, nuclear, chemical, biological, where in there do the chemical weapons fit?
Well, chemical weapons, on the one hand, are considerably less destructive than nuclear or potentially biological weapons, which are true weapons of mass destruction. Chemical weapons have been used much more extensively than either a nuclear or biological weapons, however. And they are considered more battlefield weapons than true strategic weapons, although they could conceivably be used for that purpose.
And as something that might be employed by terrorists?
That's correct. In fact, they have been employed by terrorists on a few occasions. The best known was in 1995 when a Japanese doomsday cult called the Aum Shinrikyo released a relatively small amount of sarin nerve agent on the Tokyo subway, killing 12 people and injuring upwards of 1,000. So that's the best known incident of chemical terrorism to date.
Mm-hmm. You can see, and you mention that chemicals have been used in warfare really going back a long way, even into antiquity. There are examples. You can find examples. But I suppose for most people, when you think of chemical warfare, the modern age of chemical warfare starts with World War I.
Yes, that's correct.
Which was the place where we saw the first large-scale use. And in that particular case, it was by Germany, and the agent that they used was chlorine. And initially, it was there are still today problems with how it is you deploy these things, how it is you disperse them. But what they did initially was kind of on a crude scale, although it worked. They just assembled a large amount of chlorine. They had it in containers, and they just opened it and relied on the wind to blow it over the opposing forces.
Yes, though they had to wait 3 weeks for the wind to be blowing in the right direction. So that indicates that the use of canisters containing gas, such as chlorine, is limited in terms of its military utility.
Mm-hmm. So this was something apparently the British tried this too, but ran into that same sort of a problem. Then they figured out how they could put it into artillery shells. But then that became not so useful, because then the sides realized that there were ways that they could protect their troops against this. And when troops started to be issued with gas masks, that pretty much meant that particular weapon wasn't going to work anymore.
To some extent, actually, there was an ongoing chemical arms race during World War I, with each side, as more effective defenses were developed, each side developed more lethal agents. So the first gas to be used, as you mentioned, was chlorine, then somewhat later phosgene, which was 18 times more toxic than chlorine and also was difficult to detect. Mm-hmm. Chlorine had a very distinctive odor, but phosgene was harder to smell, and it had delayed effects. So by the time troops had been exposed, it was often too late. Because some hours later, their lungs would fill with fluid, and they would die.
Hmm. And then, as you say, there was this escalate. We had an escalating chemical weapons race here, because then the Germans developed mustard gas, which was something that could be absorbed through the skin. So again, that was a way to get around defenses, and then the Allies responded. So it was a case where one side would develop something, the other side would respond. The ability to defend perhaps would improve some, then somebody would develop something else, and it just kept notching its way up that way.
Yes, that's right. And mustard was a particularly insidious and horrible agent that produced, after a delay of some hours after exposure, it would produce terrible burns and blisters on the skin. And if it was inhaled, which was only the case in a minority of individuals, it was fatal. But it generally was non-fatal, but would cause terrible injuries that would put troops out of battle for long periods.
What were the attitudes toward chemical warfare among the general public, among people, and I'm still talking about here at the time World War I, attitudes among the general public, among people in government, and among the military?
Well, there was a long taboo that developed as early as antiquity against the use of toxic chemicals in war. And there are different theories about how this taboo developed, but it appears that the use of poison was seen as an insidious weapon by which the physically weak, and including women, could prevail over the strong. So that was counter to the traditional concept of war as a chivalrous contest of strength. So very early on, back in the Greek and Roman era, the use of poison in warfare became taboo, and was sometimes explicitly banned in international law. And it was also, chemical weapons were also perceived as particularly cruel and indiscriminate, because it was difficult to target combatants uniquely, and often innocent civilians who were in the vicinity of the battlefield were affected. So for these reasons, these weapons were considered unacceptable. And the reason they came to be used in World War I was a confluence of a number of factors. First, the existence of the chemical industry, which had grown up in the 19th century, particularly in Germany. So large quantities of toxic chemicals could be produced for the first time. Second, very soon after the onset of World War I in the fall of 1914, it settled into a bloody stalemate of trench warfare in which neither side was able to advance, and they just hammered each other with artillery. And there was a desperation on both sides to come up with a new technology to force the enemy from his trenches so that they could actually advance and conquer territory. And a brilliant young chemist by the name of Fritz Haber, who was then the head of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry in Berlin, and a fascinating personality, developed the idea of using toxic chemicals to overcome the stalemate of trench warfare. And he managed to persuade the German general staff to at least try this new weapon on an experimental basis. And it was used for the first time on April 22nd, 1915, at Ypres in Belgium.
The opinion on these weapons was so much against their use that after the war, there was a treaty. The League of Nations developed a treaty. This was, I believe, 1925.
Correct.
And 16 nations signed on to it, including the United States, although...
No, the United States did not join the Geneva Protocol.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought the U.S. was one of the... Well, okay. Maybe I better back up here. Who signed on to this protocol? There.
All of the major powers except Japan and the United States signed on to the Geneva Protocol. And Germany, of course, under the Treaty of Versailles, was banned from reacquiring chemical weapons, though they did so secretly in collaboration with the Bolsheviks, ironically enough. But the sense was in World War One that it was really military necessity that had driven the Germans first to break the taboo against chemical warfare. And then all sides, once the taboo was broken, there was just a massive use on all sides of these horrible weapons. And there was such a sense of horror about the effects of chemical warfare that after the war, the League of Nations negotiated what came to be called the Geneva Protocol, which banned the use of chemical and also bacteriological weapons in war, but not their development or possession.
Hmm.
So even though there was a ban on use, countries tended to ratify this treaty with reservations. For example, if they were attacked with chemical weapons, they reserved the right to retaliate in kind. Or if they were, the treaty only applied to the contracting parties, so that countries that did not sign up to the treaty were not necessarily protected from chemical attack. So because of these reservations and the fact that it was only a ban on use, countries continued to do research and development and even to stockpile chemical weapons despite the Geneva Protocol.
Hmm. So I suppose you might make the argument that signing on to an agreement like that was sort of empty, and yet a number of nations did.
It was tantamount to a no first use agreement. So it was a significant step forward in outlawing chemical warfare, but by no means sufficient. And in fact, it took another 50 years to negotiate a true ban, the Chemical Weapons Convention, which only entered into force in 1997.
So why did the United States not sign on to this in 1925?
Well, there was a lot of resistance to the treaty. It was not considered effective. And also, the Army Chemical Warfare Service, which had been established during the war, became a very strong proponent of chemical weapons for their own organizational survival. And Amos Fries, the head of the Chemical Warfare Service, lobbied Congress very effectively. And also, he was supported by the chemical industry, which at that time was involved in the production of chemical weapons, including the American Chemical Society. And together, these forces managed to prevent the treaty from being voted on in the Senate. And the treaty was just ultimately withdrawn by President Truman. It had sort of languished on the docket of the Senate for many years. Finally, was withdrawn. And it was only during the Ford administration that the Geneva Protocol was finally ratified by the United States in 1975.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Jonathan Tucker. He is a chemical and biological weapons specialist at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and he is the author of a recently published book that looks at the modern history of chemical warfare. His book is titled War of Nerves. It's published by Pantheon, and it looks at that period from World War One to the present. Questions are certainly welcome. We do have someone standing by. We will get right to them, and welcome others. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. And our caller is in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Let me meander a little bit, memories. What I'm going for is culpability, overall structure of this question. I remember when I was younger... used to be a lot of things in magazines and papers about Krupp, K-R-U-P-P, the arms manufacturer. Christ even, you know, used movies, you know, around that situation. And I was wondering, and especially since right there at the end you mentioned the American Chemical Society, you know, my God, what kind of brethren we got here, getting involved in this politically and, of course, the chemical industry. I was wondering if you could, and if you can legally, just sort of name names and, you know, who decides, does, you know, let's for names to say come up with Merck has found something nice and new that will kill you quickly. And, you know, maybe lay on the ground for a while to get other people to come by and pick you up and kill you, too. Is this come down from the government, these ideas, or are they, you know, sort of come out of the field? Or is there just a regular industry that that's basically how these guys use their PhDs? Thanks a lot.
Well, can you make some kind of response to that, Mr. Tucker?
Yeah, I think the history of the development of the nerve agents is very instructive. The nerve agents were a radically more potent class of chemical warfare agents that were developed during the 1930s, initially in Germany. And actually, they were discovered accidentally. There was a chemist by the name of Gerhard Schroeder, who was then working for the IG Farben company, which was by far the largest chemical company in the world at the time, probably the most sophisticated. And he was doing research on a new class of pesticides and just stumbled across an extraordinarily powerful poison that came to be known as tabin. And he first discovered it. He was seeing a wide variety of new chemicals, and one of them began to have very powerful physiological effects on him as he was doing the research. He developed a dramatic dimming and blurring of vision, shortness of breath, excess saliva, and runny nose. And he sent this chemical to the lab to be analyzed in terms of its toxicity, and they found that it was literally hundreds of times more powerful than mustard or phosgene, which were the most powerful chemicals previously developed as weapons. Actually, Schroeder, under an edict that had been passed by the Nazi regime in 1935, was required to report this new chemical to the Army Ordnance Office, which was in charge of developing new chemical weapons. So it was really an accident that led to the development of the nerve agents. And the same was true of the next generation of nerve agents during the 1950s, which were again discovered by accident during pesticide research in Britain at Imperial Chemical Industries that led to the development of the V agents. Mm-hmm. So, but there was, as the caller pointed out, in the World War I, World War II era, there was a close cooperation between government and industry in the production of these weapons, but it was driven primarily by government, and they would contract to chemical industry to build the plants, which were then run by government agencies. So I should also add that the American Chemical Society and the chemical industry have completely changed their attitude toward these weapons, and they became very strong advocates of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which bans the development, production, stockpiling, and use of these weapons. So there was a watershed that occurred, I think, in more recent history in terms of attitudes toward chemical warfare. Hmm.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the Germans developed these, developed three very powerful nerve agents and developed ways also to use them on the battlefield.
Yes.
The notable thing, though, is that they never did. They didn't
yes.
deploy these weapons. And that's one of the interesting questions is, why is it that they had them, but they never used them?
Yeah, and historians have debated the non-use of chemical warfare in World War II because all of the major powers had large stockpiles of these weapons, and they were often deployed close to the battlefield. In fact, they were used on a few occasions in small quantities, but it never escalated the way it did in World War I. And as I document in the book in some detail, Hitler hesitated, and he often considered the use of these weapons, particularly as the tide of war turned against him on the Eastern Front, and he seriously considered their use against the Red Army. But he was deterred by a number of factors. First, Hitler himself had been gassed in World War I Toward the end of the war, he was exposed to mustard gas and temporarily blinded, and that was a deeply traumatic experience for him. So he had a personal aversion to chemical warfare because of that experience. Secondly, the German intelligence, the Abwehr, actually falsely or incorrectly assessed the capabilities of the Allies in chemical warfare. And they believed that the Allies had also developed nerve agents, and that was not the case. They were working very hard to do so, but they did not make the same accidental breakthrough that Gerhard Schroeder made, so that the organophosphate chemicals they developed were much less potent and much less effective as weapons. So even though the Germans had this secret weapon and they had a monopoly in the nerve agents, they were not confident enough that they would not be exposed to severe retaliation. And toward the end of the war, or the late stage of the war, when Germany seriously considered the use of these weapons, the Allies had air superiority over Germany, and German cities were extremely vulnerable. So they were very afraid of chemical retaliation if they used the weapons first. And then finally, another factor, and nobody knows how important this was the existence of the Geneva Protocol, the fact that these weapons had been outlawed under international law. Germany had signed the Geneva Protocol. Of course, Hitler violated all kinds of other international laws, so it's doubtful that that alone could explain the non-use. But the German military disliked these weapons, did not really incorporate them into their logistics and military doctrine. So they were really not prepared to use chemical weapons, even though they were stockpiled in large quantities.
We have several other callers, and we'll get right to them in just a moment. Just, let me ask just one more question. It's my understanding that here the Allies, after the war, were a little bit surprised and were caught off guard by just how advanced the German nerve agent effort had been, at least for whatever kind of research we were doing. We didn't have anything like Tabun. And what they did was immediately the United States and Britain and Russia took advantage of the work the Nazis had done. They took some of the people who had done that research and then had them work for them, and they immediately started working on the same things. And in fact, at one point, the United States actually did start to produce sarin, which was a nerve agent that had been developed by the Nazis. And so, again, here the question might be here, in fact, during World War II, we still seem to have reluctance about the use of these weapons. They weren't deployed, at least not on a large scale, on a battlefield. So there, again, here would have been an opportunity to strengthen a kind of an international commitment against them. But instead, we had, again, another kind of arms race going here involving the Soviet Union and the United States and also Britain. So there again, that gets us to this question: is what could there have been at this point? Was there some kind of interest? Could there have been any interest in saying, "Let's just not do this. Let's stop this"?
Yeah, I think sort of the leitmotif of this history is the conflict between the taboo and restoring the taboo, and the concept of military necessity or military utility, because there was a bureaucracy that was established during World War I, the Chemical Warfare Service, which later became the Army Chemical Corps, which became a very strong bureaucratic advocate of chemical weapons. And they had their allies in Congress, so that was one factor. And some military strategists believed that chemical weapons had shown some utility on the battlefield, and that we could not afford to ignore these weapons if other countries were going to develop them. In fact, the main rationale for the U.S. Was to develop a deterrent, an in-kind deterrent, so that the Soviets and their allies would not have an advantage, if only by forcing U.S. troops into protective gear, which is very uncomfortable and unwieldy and significantly impairs military effectiveness, even in the use of conventional weapons. So there were many factors of a military nature that drove the chemical arms race. And it was also driven by the mad logic of the Cold War, the same logic that drove the nuclear arms race. The chemical arms race was much less prominent, but it ran in parallel to the nuclear arms race. And it was equal levels of overproduction and overkill. Literally thousands of tons of super toxic chemicals were stockpiled on both sides, more than enough to kill the entire population of both countries. So it was part of that mad psychosis, I would say, of the Cold War.
We are at our midpoint. We have several callers, and we'll get right to them. But I do, again, want to introduce our guest, Jonathan Tucker. He has, for the past 10 years, been a chemical and biological weapons specialist at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Before that, he worked as an arms control specialist for Congress and the State Department, and also as a journalist. He was editor at Scientific American and also High Technology Magazine, where he wrote about biomedical research, biotechnology, and also military technologies. He's the author of a recent book that looks at the modern history of chemical warfare from World War I to the present. His book is titled War of Nerves, and it's published by Pantheon. We have a number of callers, so we'll get back to them, starting with somebody in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Two questions. The second one has to do with what you think George Bush's impact has been, especially now that we know the revelation from the Seymour Hersh article in the current New Yorker, his impact on attempts to curtail the spread of weapons of mass destruction. But the first question is historical in terms of Vietnam. What perspective would you put the defoliant Agent Orange in terms of chemical weaponry in warfare? In other words, is that actually a form of chemical warfare, even though it may, quote-unquote, not be on the battlefield? Or, I mean, just where would that fit in the annals of chemical warfare?
Okay. Agent Orange was a herbicide that was used to defoliate the jungle and expose the Viet Cong guerrillas to aerial attack. It is, under international law, not considered a chemical weapon, even though it is a chemical, but because it works primarily on vegetation rather than human beings, the reason Agent Orange is toxic to human beings is because of a synthetic byproduct of its synthesis called dioxin, and that is simply a contaminant, usually present in extremely small amounts, but because such vast quantities of Agent Orange were dispersed over Vietnam, the relatively small amount of or proportion of dioxin was enough to cause very significant injuries to the Vietnamese population and of course, to American troops that were exposed to it. And even today, there are birth defects and other injuries attributable to Agent Orange in Vietnam. So it's had a long legacy. But it is not considered a chemical weapon because its primary aim was not to poison humans, but rather to defoliate. A number of countries did accuse the U.S. of using tear gas, we did use tear gas. A number of countries considered that to be chemical warfare, but the U.S. always insisted that tear gas was not a chemical weapon because its effects were transitory. That was a controversy during the Vietnam War.
There was a tear gas used in Vietnam?
Yes, large quantities of tear gas were used in Vietnam in tactical operations, for example, clearing of tunnels, rescuing of downed pilots behind enemy lines. And a number of particularly East Bloc countries at the time accused the U.S. of violating the Geneva Protocol by using tear gas. But the U.S. always insisted tear gas was not a chemical weapon and it was a riot control agent. And that was not banned under the protocol. Also, the U.S. was not a party to the Geneva Protocol until after the end of the Vietnam War. We only ratified the treaty in 1975.
Thank you. I just briefly wanted to bring in Bush here because it is a question of weapons of mass destruction across the board that we're worried about. Now we have Bush putting nuclear weapons as a threat on the table, at least indirectly through the revelations of the Hersh article. But that's one thing. What does that do? What does that say to the world? And secondly, if in fact he uses a nuclear weapon against Iran, what is that going to say to the world?
Well, I'm not an expert on nuclear weapons, but it would seem to me that it's in our interest to try to legitimate these weapons, and that if we actually use them, nuclear weapons have not been used since 1945, that would send a terrible message to the rest of the world. So I think that I would be very surprised if that idea was being seriously considered by the administration.
Well, that's what the Hirsch article says, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Let's go on here. We have another caller in Champaign County, and this is line two. Hello.
Hi. The Vietnam question is important, and I understand there are some allegations that actually BX was used to clear tunnels, and I don't know if there's anything true to that, but truth is not big in a government state's mind when it's nominally at war or when it's really at war. As far as naming names, this document dump that the Iraqis did, I think that was kind of let go, but not widely disseminated in the U.S. It seems the U.S. basically was more of a financier of that, collaborator of the ANFAR. It'll be interesting to see if any of the judicial proceedings in Iraq go on long enough to inquire as to who was cooperating with the ANFAR. But I also wanted to look a little historically, and that has to do with Iraq in the 30s. People say that Winston Churchill is being in charge of, I think, one of the colonial portfolios was involved in at least signing on to using some kind of chemical weapon to put down uprisings in Iraq in the 30s. I don't know whether that was just mustard gas or what. I've been waiting a while on the phone. I'm just going to line out a couple more things if I could, and then I'll just hang up. But there are other protocols. I don't want to confuse it with the Geneva protocols, but the U.S. has been, even before Bush got in, rather recalcitrant to accept protocols of inspection, and the big chemical industry apparently was said to be quite important in scuttling some implementation of what we've nominally supposedly signed on to, but the U.S., as opposed to the European countries, seems to be less inclined to allow on-site inspections of chemical plants. And if you don't do it yourself, how can you ask someone else to do it, right?
Okay. Well,
so I think the mad psychosis of the Cold War is still apparently too around, and that actually was pointed to by the previous caller as well. I'll hang up. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me try to answer those questions. The first reference to the alleged use of nerve agents in Vietnam has been extensively debunked. This was the so-called Operation Tailwind story that was that appeared on CNN. Some years ago, and there was a claim that U.S. forces had used sarin for certain special operations in Vietnam. That has been debunked, and in fact, CNN withdrew that story. So I don't think there's really any solid historical evidence behind that idea. On the issue of U.S. support to Iraq, it's true that a number of Western chemical companies and equipment suppliers were implicated in the Iraqi chemical weapons program, and I described that in some detail in the book. There were two American companies that I am aware of, one of which was called Alkalac. It has since gone out of business, but they were supplying the immediate precursor for mustard gas to Iraq. So they must have had some. They must have been somewhat knowledgeable about what was going on there. I think it would be hard to come up with a peaceful justification for supplying large quantities of thiodiglycol, that particular chemical, to Iraq. So there were not only American companies, but many European, particularly German and Swiss companies, that were implicated in supplying the Iraqi chemical weapons program. There's plenty of blame to go around there. Then the third question that dealt with the willingness of the chemical industry to accept inspections, that in fact is incorrect. The chemical industry has been really outstanding in its support of the Chemical Weapons Treaty, the Chemical Weapons Convention of 1997. And if it hadn't been for support from the chemical industry, that treaty never would have been ratified by the U.S. Senate. I think what the caller is referring to is the Biological Weapons Convention, a different treaty for which an inspection protocol was negotiated over a period of 7 years. And the pharmaceutical industry, not the chemical industry, pharmaceutical industry was resistant to having on-site inspections at its facilities because of concern about loss of proprietary information. They lobbied against the protocol, and the Bush administration, shortly after it came to power in 2001, decided to withdraw from those negotiations and repudiated the draft protocol. So, but that was biological, not chemical, and I know people tend to confuse the two. Mm.
The other thing, and I think it is interesting as an historical point, given the way a lot of people felt about chemical warfare after World War I, it is apparently true that Winston Churchill authorized the use of chemical weapons in what is now Iraq against forces that were Kurds and Arabs who were protesting the British occupation there. This, I believe, was 1920. And I also believe that actually, though, although the use of these weapons had been, he did sign off on them, they never actually were used.
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of uses in the interwar period. The most infamous is Mussolini's use of mustard gas in Abyssinia, present-day Ethiopia, in 1936, and that was a flagrant violation of the Geneva Protocol, and the League of Nations really did nothing to stop it. So that's been another pattern. When there has been use, the international community is often reluctant to enforce these treaties. The most recent example of that was during the Iran-Iraq War, when Iraq used chemical weapons on a very large scale, including nerve agents, against Iran. And because the West didn't want Iran to win the war, they looked the other way. And that seriously undermined the international norm against chemical warfare.
Mm-hmm. We continue. Let's talk with someone in a nearby community of Belgium. This is Line 3. Hello.
Good morning. To start with a lighter notion at first, I am very envious of where you work, sir, there on the Presidio of Monterey, overlooking, Monterey Bay?
Actually, I think the guest works in Washington now.
Oh, well, I thought he said about Monterey.
Well, I used to live in Monterey for 5 years, but for the past 5 years, I've been in our Washington, D.C. office, so the view here is not quite
as nice. The view is not quite as nice.
Yeah, that's terribly unfortunate.
Right.
Having been in D.C. too, the two don't compare. But to get to an aspect that you probably haven't talked much about, here where I'm located at, we're about 30 miles away from Newport, Indiana, which is a very large repository of VX, which they're trying now to destroy. And they seem to be going at it very, very slowly. They have to empty these carbolloids and then go through a process of deactivating it or whatever you want to call it. And it seems to be fraught with many, many problems. And they start and stop and start and stop. Is that the nature all over the United States, or is this the only place left that is still doing this because the others have already been deactivated?
Well, there are eight chemical depots around the United States that still store significant quantities of chemical weapons left over from the Cold War. A number of them are using high-temperature incineration technology, such as the plant at Tooele, Utah, or at Anniston, Alabama. Some of them that have large bulk containers, such as Aberdeen, Maryland, or Newport, Indiana, Bluegrass, Kentucky, are going to use chemical neutralization technology instead of incineration for technical reasons and also because of resistance to incineration from local communities. So that technology is very complex. It results in a large volume of neutralizate, what is left over after the super toxic chemicals have been neutralized. So you end up with a sort of a mild form of hazardous waste that then has to be disposed of in a treatment facility. There have been proposals to ship the neutralizate to the DuPont plant in New Jersey for processing. That remains very controversial, particularly in New Jersey, and is unlikely to happen anytime soon, if at all. So destroying these weapons, which are extraordinarily toxic, we're talking about VX, 10 milligrams is the lethal dose to the skin. That's a small drop on the skin is enough to kill a grown man. So when you're talking about toxins of that level of potency, destroying them is extremely costly and technically challenging. often requires the use of hermetically sealed facilities with robotic devices that handle the munitions so that they don't come in contact with human beings. We're spending upwards of $26 billion to destroy this legacy of the Cold War. So it's a major effort, and we're somewhat behind schedule. We were supposed to destroy these weapons by next year. It's clear that we're not going to make that initial deadline, and we're likely to apply for a 5-year extension under the treaty, which is permissible.
As I remember, we've been talking about this in this neighborhood. As a matter of fact, just last weekend, I think we had a big alert so that you could practice what might happen if there was some kind of event that was unfortunate in the destruction of this stuff. We've been talking about this now for pretty close to 10 years in this location, if not longer. Seems like there's never going to be an end to it. Is there other compounds that are going to be just as deadly or possibly as deadly we're going to have to deal with in some other group?
Well, under the Chemical Weapons Convention, there can be no further production of chemical weapons. So we are simply dealing with the legacy of the massive production of these supertoxic chemicals during the Cold War. And we're not the only country that has this problem. Russia has an even larger stockpile that they inherited from the Soviet Union, and they're even further behind schedule in destroying them. And they face enormous technical and financial challenges. So, in fact, the United States is helping to pay for the destruction of Russia's chemical weapons.
Mm.
So this is there are six countries that, under the treaty, that have declared stockpiles of these weapons and are in the process of destroying them, not only the U.S. and Russia, but also India, South Korea, Albania, Libya. And these countries are all facing more. The other countries have much smaller stockpiles, so it's not as much of a challenge. But for example, Libya has just asked the United States for assistance to destroy its stockpile of mustard gas.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Hope you get back to Monterey.
Well, are there in addition to those countries that have said yes, we have this stuff, and yes, we want to get rid of it? Do we know that there are other countries who perhaps have some, who maybe haven't declared, or maybe even if they have, they don't have the means or the will to get rid of them?
Well, there are a number of countries that have not yet signed up to the Chemical Weapons Convention. The vast majority of countries have. 178 countries to date have signed and ratified this treaty, which is impressive. But there are some important countries that we know or suspect have chemical weapons and have not agreed to get rid of them, and they include North Korea, of course, which is a major concern. Their chemical weapons are targeted on Seoul. Egypt, Syria, Israel may have a small stockpile. We just don't know. And these countries remain outside the regime, and in the case of Egypt and Syria, they have reserved the right. They don't admit having chemical weapons, but they have reserved in principle the right to possess them as long as Israel has nuclear weapons. So it's a bit of a real knot, a Gordian knot, and it's going to be difficult to find a way to cut that knot.
Yeah. About 10 minutes left. We have one more caller here we'll get right to. Again, I just want to introduce the guest, Jonathan Tucker. He is a chemical and biological weapons specialist at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and he lives in Washington, D.C. He is author of a book looking at the history of modern chemical warfare. His book is titled War of Nerves, and it's published by Pantheon. Next, we have someone on a cell phone to talk with here, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to start out with compliments to our guest for his vast knowledge. My question derives a bit from your speaking of tear gas. Has there been any research, or is there any, into more benign forms of chemical weapons, like something to put everybody to sleep, or cause temporary paralysis, or set everybody laughing, or something?
Yes. These agents are called incapacitants or calmatives, and there is active research going on both in Russia and the United States to develop a new generation of chemical agents that would be so-called non-lethal, though a number of people take issue with that whole concept, because non-lethality really depends on how these chemicals are used, the concentration, the way they're administered. And we saw a pretty dramatic demonstration of that in 2002 during the siege of a Moscow theater that was taken over by Chechen rebels. You may recall the Dubrovka theater incident. And in that case, the Russian special forces surrounded the theater, and there was a standoff for a few days. And then finally, they pumped an incapacitating gas into the theater, which knocked out the rebels, and they were basically they were killed at point-blank range. But over 100 of the hostages inside the theater also died from exposure to this supposedly non-lethal gas. And part of the problem was the Russians refused to reveal the composition of the gas so that it was not possible to administer antidotes in a timely fashion. But I think that's a cautionary tale. It shows that so-called incapacitating gases can be lethal if they're in insufficient concentration, that there's no such thing as a knockout gas that is always non-lethal under all circumstances. And secondly, I have real concerns about the use in counter-terrorist or paramilitary situations of incapacitating gases, that it could seriously undermine the ban on lethal chemicals, because there is a long tendency or history of use of non-lethal gases, such as tear gas, on the battlefield, rapidly escalating to the use of lethal agents.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Can we here, where we've got maybe about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I guess one thing that I'm continued to want to continue to talk about are some of the proliferation issues here. Now, we've talked about the fact that there are 175 countries that have signed on to the Chemical Weapons Convention, and we have a number of them who have said, have made this pledge that this, they're going to destroy the stockpiles of these things that they have. At the same time, though, we know that there are these weapons, that they exist, that security protecting them is an issue, that there, and there are non-state actors that would be happy to get their hands on some of these things, either a finished product or the expertise to manufacture it. What are the countries of the world doing to try to prevent things like that from happening?
Well, there are a number of initiatives that have been taken. I mean, under the Chemical Weapons Convention deals primarily with states and state-level programs, though there are some provisions of the treaty that focus on national implementation. So, for example, making the provisions of the treaty binding on individual citizens who might be involved in production of chemical weapons. So there are legal sanctions that states can apply to individuals that are violating those provisions. And also there are a number of other measures that have been taken recently at the international level. The Security Council passed a resolution called 1540, which requires all members of the United Nations to take measures to prevent weapons of mass destruction, materials and equipment, from falling into the hands of terrorists and other sub-state actors. So that's a positive step. The Bush administration has also emphasized interdiction, the so-called Proliferation Security Initiative, under which the U.S. and other states voluntarily agree to cooperate to block shipments or transfers of chemical ingredients and equipment that might be used by proliferators or terrorists. But I think the Bush administration has somewhat neglected the role of international treaties. They tend to, I think, underestimate the importance of international norms and treaties. And so they have not provided as much funding and support for implementation of the Chemical Weapons Convention as I would like.
And we talked about the fact that there are a number of countries that have made this commitment to destroy their chemical weapons stockpiles, and that, in fact, originally the idea was that that was supposed to be done by next year, and that we're all way behind, and so it looks as if that date is going to be extended. I mean, does that simply go to the issue that the things that we're talking about are extremely dangerous, and that perhaps even once we render them non-lethal, we're still going to have things that are extremely, extremely toxic, so that they're very difficult to handle. Is the fact that we're behind have something to do with the technical issues, or does that also say something about the commitment of various countries, including ours, to actually do this and put the necessary resources into doing it?
I think the U.S. is and Russia are committed to destroying these weapons, but there have been, I think, for one thing, the treaty was overly optimistic in that the that all of the weapons could be destroyed in 10 years after entry into force. I mean, the U.S. had roughly 30,000 metric tons. The Russians had more than 40,000 metric tons of super toxic chemicals, and just this is a huge undertaking to destroy that level of hazardous material in a safe and environmentally responsible way. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, we would simply dump obsolete chemical weapons offshore in the ocean, and I think we've progressed to the point where we realize that that is not a good idea from the standpoint of protecting the environment. But destroying, this super hazardous waste in a responsible way is very costly and very difficult. So we also have to deal with political problems, both at the national, state, and local levels. Permits have to be obtained from state and local governments. There's a lot of political resistance on the part of nearby communities that live near these chemical weapons depots that want to make sure that they will be safe in the event of an accident, or that they won't be exposed to toxic chemicals from incineration, for example. So all of these factors have to be taken into account during the destruction process. So I think it's not surprising that we're behind schedule, and in fact the treaty does have a provision for a 5-year extension. Now, after 2012, that's when there will be perhaps a moment of reckoning. I think the U.S. will probably make the 2012 deadline, but I'm very doubtful that Russia will. So there may have to be an amendment or a modification to the treaty to permit Russia to enable them to take more time.
Well, we'll have to stop there with the suggestion that if people would like to read more on the subject of modern chemical warfare, you can look for the book we've talked about. It's titled War of Nerves. It's published by Pantheon by our guest, Jonathan Tucker. He is chemical and biological weapons specialist at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. And Dr. Tucker, thank you very much.
Thank you.